You're listening to TIP.
Connecting back to Antifragile and something that Nassim Taleb talks about is this concept of via negativa. And so, you know, we often, when we think about whether it's with our health, our relationships, with our money, we think about, you know, how can we add more? And somehow we're going to add something that's going to help us. And it's going to be some new supplement or some vitamin, or, you know, we're going to add more exercise into our routine, or we're going to add this stock to our portfolio. And it's going to dramatically improve things. And, you know, the principle of via negativa is, you know, first, let's focus on what we should avoid. What should we not do? And so, you know, maybe with health, it's like, okay, well, rather than trying to trade to run a marathon, well, let's start with cutting out the junk food or, you know, whatever it is. And literally the via negativa and just removing the things that are weighing on you or killing you or whatever it is. And instantly you could have order of magnitudes improvement in the structure of your portfolio or your health or whatever it is.
Hey guys, in today's episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down and talking with my good buddies and colleagues, Sean O'Malley and Matthew Gutierrez, who are the main drivers of our financial newsletter, We Study Markets. You'll learn what it's been like writing and creating for the newsletter, who their biggest financial influences have been, how they structure their own portfolios, what an average day is like for a newsletter writer, and what future plans they have to offer more value to our readers. Sean is the chief editor for We Study Markets, and he's been working on the newsletter since its inception in July of 2022. He graduated magna cum laude from Elon University, where he studied finance and entrepreneurship. Matthew is a writer and editor that has reported for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. He graduated from Syracuse University with degrees in journalism and finance. These are two super smart guys. I really admire them. Crafting and creating a daily newsletter is incredibly difficult. And these guys do a fantastic job putting out We Study Markets, creating content that is just super applicable and timely and well-researched and thoughtful. Without further delay, let's dive into today's episode with Sean O'Malley and Matthew Gutierrez of our newsletter, We Study Markets.
Celebrating 10 years, you are listening to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network. Since 2014, we interviewed successful entrepreneurs, business leaders, and investors to help educate and inspire the millennial generation. Now for your host, Patrick Donnelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Millennial Investing Podcast. I'm your host today, Patrick Donnelly. And joining me in today's studio is Matthew Gutierrez and Sean O'Malley. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
So for our listeners that don't know, these are the guys behind We Study Markets, our newsletter. I admire both of you quite a bit. I wrote for the newsletter for a little bit, 6 months or so, and writing is extremely difficult. And I just really want to say right off the bat, like, I really admire you guys to produce the amount of content that you do on a daily basis that's high quality and really well done. So I first want to start off with you, Sean. Just I want to talk a little bit about both your backgrounds. Talk to me about just college, post-college experiences, and then your transition to TIP and getting into the financial markets and writing.
I mean, well, for me, my financial markets and investing origin story, I guess, starts probably around like middle school, high school. I'm kind of embarrassed to say now, I used to be a frequent watcher of Jim Cramer's Mad Money. And so that's where my story begins, is just seeing that show on TV weeknights. And I remember in the evenings rushing home to watch it. And that was when the first stock I traded, I tried to do the IPO of Fitbit. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I loved the energy of it. I loved the complexity of financial markets. And so I was intrigued. And I guess, you know, flash forward a few years and I'm at college and I'm officially studying finance. And then all of a sudden the world is upended by the COVID-19 pandemic. And so, you know, I'm sent home and I've been home for like 2 weeks now and I'm already being driven crazy by the boredom. You can't go out and do anything. You can't see any friends. You go from this like environment where you're with your friends 24/7 and all of a sudden now you're just in isolation with your parents and your family. And so I was looking for some kind of outlet, I guess. And I remember just being out on a walk and literally being in the woods and searching on my phone. You know, I should listen to something productive that's going to make me better. And so I typed investing podcasts into my Spotify search feed. And the Investors Podcast Network popped up. And so that was literally how I started. I, from that moment, started listening to Preston and Sig's We Study Billionaires episodes. And I tried to get through as many as I can. I probably went through dozens or hundreds before I ended up going back to school that fall. And and ever since then, I've been, you know, I was a weekly listener of TIP for another, you know, 2 years after that. And I just started my first job in the real world and was trying my hand at being an adult and going down a very conventional financial track and studying to be, you know, to earn a CFA license and to, you know, like I said, try to work very traditional kind of Wall Street jobs. And I saw a job posting to work at TIP and I gave it a shot. I saw a shot over an email. And I think, you know, maybe what stood out in my application was that I had highlighted all the books I read. I made a point of listing every book I'd read in the last 2 or 3 years. And I think it stood out to Stig, who reviewed my application, because they'd all been books he recommended on the podcast. Basically, every time him or Preston recommended a book, I went out and bought it and read it. And so that was enough to get me my first interview with the company. And it actually took me a few rounds of interviews and some convincing, but, you know, eventually Stig gave me a chance and I was brought on to bring the newsletter to life, which I know you had an early hand in, Patrick, and it was fun to kind of jointly launch it together.
That's awesome. I want to get into those books here a little later and the transition into TIP and your experience at TIP. But Matthew, I wanted to hear too, first about your background, school, and kind of post-college transition out of college.
Sure. So I grew up in right outside of Princeton, New Jersey, went to Syracuse, studied journalism and finance, but was probably skewed 80% journalism and writing. Kind of just did what I had to do at the business school basically to get by. And then similar story during 2020, like a lot of people, just became infatuated with markets. Part of that surely because seemingly everything was going upward, but also because I really just enjoyed learning about companies, learning about their stories, origin stories, founder stories, and what makes great investing, what makes great companies that drive our economy and, you know, in some ways drive our world, right? And jobs can be, you know, a calling, but jobs are also a livelihood. And we spend so much time working and trying to earn money so that we can live lives that we want to live. So that just became really interesting for me. And at the time, I was working at The Athletic as a sports writer, really nothing to do with financial markets. But evenings, mornings, you know, during breaks, weekends, I would just be listening to, similar to Sean, the Investors podcast, other podcasts, watching YouTube videos. CNBC was on in the background, for better or for worse. And just trying to learn and pick up information, learn some of the lingo, tickers, and just get acclimated with the whole space. And then quickly zooming sort of out financially, investing, I did not do much at all. But I will say one of the biggest influences was my mom started a small account for me when I was growing up, helped fund a very expensive college tuition at a private school in Syracuse. But it also, she bought just a small amount of Apple stock when I was little. And it's a gigantic amount, but it's turned into a much bigger amount than what she had invested initially. And I was just amazed that I didn't do anything. She didn't do anything outside of the, you know, the initial foresight and investment. And we didn't, you know, we didn't monitor headlines, news, and all the bearish calls the last 15 years on Apple and other mega cap stocks, all the, you know, rode through the 2008 financial crisis, 2016, a little dip, 2018, the dip at the end of the year. Obviously, 2020, I think it, you know, shed huge value. And ever since then, it's just continued to you know, drive upward despite headlines. And again, didn't read any annual reports, didn't listen to Tim Cook on any calls, but just kind of wrote it out.
That's awesome. I think that's such a great experience to just have that. First of all, that your mom did that and to just the whole buy and hold and just sit through it, through the ups and downs and not pay attention to too much noise. It can really shake people out, I think. Sean, I wanted to get back to you and the investing books that you read that Stig had recommended. What were some of the ones that you really did made an impact on you?
Yeah, I mean, there were so many great ones. One that really stood out, and I don't remember if it was Stig or Preston who recommended it or where the recommendation came from, but one of the most impactful that's changed the way I think about the world is Nassim Taleb's Incerto, his series of books, Fooled by Randomness, Black Swan, and Antifragile. I've actually only read Black Swan and Antifragile, so I can't speak as much on Fooled by Randomness, but those books are just talk about a contrarian mindset and a willingness to think differently. That's really the vibe I get from Nassim Taleb. And, you know, he's controversial. Some people don't like his work. Some people don't like his personality, but, you know, just kind of isolating the work for what it is, it's incredible to think about the kind of the many different biases and the very common ones that people think about are, you know, like overconfidence biases and confirmation biases and those sort of things. But the more subtler biases of, you know, I think he uses in that book an example of whenever something goes wrong, for example, we all fixate on the event that happened. And so, for example, when a plane crashes, everybody fixates on the tragedy and, you know, what could have been avoided. But every time something or a system in place works the way it's supposed to and prevents a plane from crashing or your car from crashing or some other tragedy, those events don't get headlines because we just take them for granted. You know, everything worked as it was supposed to do. And it's not just magic that things work the way they're supposed to do. You know, systems are designed to be robust. And that, for me, was one of the really interesting takeaways from both Antifragile and Black Swan, of thinking about, you know, from the Black Swan aspect of it, you can have these crises that seemingly come out of nowhere that in hindsight were predictable, using like COVID, for example. Nobody in January 2020 that I was interacting with was expecting, you know, a global pandemic that was going to derail the global economy for 2 years. But it came. And now in hindsight, we can say, oh, well, you know, in 2018 or 2019, the World Health Organization warned about the possibility. And you can imagine a pandemic is not an unpredictable event, but it still took the world by shock.
Yep.
And so for me, the kind of takeaway that I internalized from that and also from his book, Antifragile, is how can you build your portfolio to not just prepare for these kind of catastrophic risks and that you can't necessarily anticipate, but also, you know, one of the concepts that Nassim Taleb talks about in Antifragile is, well, literally anti-fragility. And it's not just robustness. It's not an ability to, you know, handle stress. It's actually getting stronger from stressors. And so it's almost like, I think an example he uses in that book is, you know, exercise. Whenever you lift weights, you run, you're putting stress on your body, you're putting a strain on your body, but now your body is getting stronger. And so it's reacting in an anti-fragile way. You're making your body less fragile by strengthening it. And I'm certainly not an expert on option strategies and volatility and those sort of things, but it was really compelling to me to not just think more intentionally about the risks that we're taking in the world and the systems that are designed to mitigate those risks, but also within our portfolios. You know, for example, how can you make your portfolio anti-fragile? And instead of being short volatility, as most portfolios are, maybe you can structure it to be long volatility. And so you can actually some fracture of your portfolio can have an asymmetric gain when there's a market crash. Those are the kind of things that flip my paradigm upside down. You know, you don't learn that in your traditional business school class to think about those kind of catastrophic risks and how you can actually, you know, become anti-fragile to them. But for me, that was a very eye-opening type of book to read. And I've continued to enjoy keeping up with his work over the years.
Yeah, those are good points. Great books. I think Clay just did a review of one of Nassim's books. Isn't that how he structured his portfolio when he was managing money? It's like 90% pretty conservative. And then the remaining 10%, like you said, taking asymmetric bets. But if the black swan hits, then it's like, you know, really juices the returns.
Yeah, I think he called it the barbell approach.
Right.
And the idea is you have, you know, maybe 90% of your portfolio in treasury bonds or the S&P 500, you know, whatever your preferred strategy is there with the bulk of your portfolio. And then 10% of it is, you know, deep out of the money options that give you that asymmetric kind of long volatility return sequence in those. You know, volatility mostly works in one way. We don't usually have days where the stock market gaps higher by 50%, but we do have weeks where the stock market has fallen by 50%. And so there is like, you know, volatility technically can go both ways, but realistically, it's you're preparing your portfolio to benefit from downsides. And so, you know, the typical advice is to have a 60-40 bond portfolio, but sophisticated enough. And I don't necessarily claim to be. I know that there's some strategies to do it. And that's one of the things that Nassim Taleb is known for.
I wanted to get into your portfolios here shortly. But Matthew, I know that you read really broadly, not just finance books, more philosophy, spirituality, all kinds of stuff, which I really appreciate. I'm the same way. What are some of the books that have made a big impact recently that you've been reading, or it could be investment books, or really just however you want to take it in terms of books that have made a big impact on you?
Yeah, so it's a great question. Always reading a variety. Like, so I'll have financial books on the nightstand, and then, you know, by the couch, I'll have a meditation book, and on my bookshelf, I'll just pull off a biography or a memoir from an investor or a writer or an athlete. So I try to mix it up. Part of that is to keep things fresh, keep topics fresh, different writing styles fresh, and just getting acclimated with how different people write, tell stories, and see the world. So I try to not be, you know, read all equities or all, you know, Bitcoin books. There are a few big ones out there now, or all Zen and mindfulness books, because I think you can overdo it on that end as well, on the sort of self-help spirituality end. So
100%.
Just keeping it a balance is really key. As far as specific names, you know, I think the big ones like Psychology of Money, Same as Ever from Housel, I don't end up returning to those more than a lot of others. Love Joys of Compounding Snowball, Warren Buffett was something I haven't read every page. It is a big book. I've revisited that quite often. Quite a few other mindfulness books as well. Meditation, Wherever You Go, There You Are is on my nightstand. And then a couple others like The Almanac of Naval,
yep.
The Almanac of Balaji, which I know, Patrick, you've discussed, and you've had Eric Jorgensen on the podcast. Those are terrific books. I think they are a microcosm of what I try to read, which is they touch on financial markets, but they also touch on health, lifestyle, technology, all those things and how they're intertwined and, you know, it makes us whole, makes us human, you know, making sure that we're complete. So those are the ones that come to mind recently. And then just briefly on the value of reading, it's incredible. And TIP totally encourages this. And it's a beautiful thing. Just the, you look at any great investor, they are just reading. I think it was Oaktree, not Howard Marks, but someone there who has said, I might've been on one of our podcasts, that it's basically looks like a library to visitors at their all times.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was a perfect visual. Most of the time it looks like you're not working, but really you're just probably doing, you know, the most productive thing you could be doing as an investor.
I've seen interviews with like Monish Pabrai and Guy Spier and a number of different investors, and it's the same thing. It's like hanging out in a library, and that's, like you said, they spend most of their time reading, which is such a wonderful life, just to be able to read and learn and study and hopefully make money while you're doing it. I wanted to get a little bit into, Sean, some of you've covered and studied so much just with the newsletter. I want to talk a little bit deeper about some of your investment heroes, whether it was a podcast, you know, that you listen to, or a book, or just some of the investors that you really look up to.
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's definitely a lot of ways you could take it. For me, I've always appreciated the simplicity of Joel Greenblatt's message. And he wrote the little book that beats the market. And, you know, it's a simple premise. Focus on companies with high earnings yields and high returns on capital, and you're going to do pretty well. And he devised this, you know, quote unquote magic formula for investing. And I remember hearing that and just all my red flags shot up. And I was like, okay, this sounds like a scam. This is too good to be true. Because, you know, usually when you hear things in markets that sound too good to be true, like magic formula, you should definitely be pretty skeptical. But his data, his returns, and his strategy has been thoroughly back tested, and over multiple decades has, you know, continuously outperformed the market. And it's not really because of any magic, obviously. Really, the magic is just investing and owning in great companies with, you know, an intermediate to long term perspective, and holding on to those investments, especially when those stocks are beaten down, and, you know, really just enduring the emotional side of investing and not necessarily falling into the trap of buying the sexiest stocks that have gone up the most or have the most innovative new product that also trade at the highest price to earnings multiples. And so there's a simple and kind of elegant message to what he does. And I really appreciate too, he set up this forum called the Value Investors Club that I've tried my hand at to submit a few stock pitches to that haven't been selected. But, you know, there's a certain very high caliber of investor that he has into that forum. And the really interesting thing to me is that, you know, he set this up, and it's just an opportunity for anybody where in the world who's very sophisticated with stock investing and knows what they're doing to submit a pitch. And then there's, you know, I don't know if he personally, I think he has a team of people that review the best stock pitches that are sent in every single month. And then you basically get added as a member, and then you can see all the most recent picks. But it's not something that you can buy into. You know, there's no price tag on the membership. You have to, it's merit based. You have to earn your way in. So, you know, I don't know how many years I'll have to keep trying my hand at trying to earn my way in, but it's pretty cool that club that he's put in. And I know that just through trying to be accepted into it, I've garnered a lot of respect for the process and really his career in general with Joel Greenblatt.
It's interesting you said that. I interviewed a guy that you probably both are familiar with, Value Stock Geek, on Twitter, and he also recommended Joel Greenblatt's book as probably a good one for, well, whether beginner, intermediate, or advanced investors to check out. It's like you said, you can't argue with the returns that he's had. Probably the challenge for most people is to hold during the downturns that are likely to happen, you know, to stay with it and stick with the strategy. I think that's the challenge, is making sure you pick a strategy and stick with it. Matthew, yeah. What about you? What are some of your investment heroes? You mentioned Buffett, obviously, and Snowball, but any others that come to mind?
Yeah, well, quickly on that, Patrick, I think just the other day, it was 4 years to the day since some just massive sell-off right when COVID was beginning, and someone threw the chart up of all the sea of red that day. And I think you know, big mega cap tech firms were down 10, 12% in a day. And someone posted their prices at that time. And here we are 4 years later. So to both of your points, to be able to ride out those downturns is really where people separate themselves. And that doesn't feel like it at the time, but that's really where the returns are being made in a lot of ways. Yeah, it's pretty boring as far as the mentors, like definitely Buffett, Munger, Monish, who's a, you know, TIP family household. Those guys come back to over and over, the almanac of Charlie Munger and the snowball, which going back to my mom, I think right around 2009, right after the financial crisis, I think that book came out in 08, I want to say, or 07, correct me if I'm wrong, which is, you know, interesting timing there in itself, probably a coincidence, but that book was on my mom's nightstand. And then I just remember being a young kid, I'd probably could not comprehend most of it, but just being enamored by that and seeing, that's interesting. I wonder who that guy is, and just sort of keeping him in the back of my mind. We did have, you know, a small allocation to Berkshire Hathaway as well. Yeah, I always stick to the Buffett Munger approach, or at least I'm saying I am. You know, we'll see the next downturn. Hopefully I do. But just long-term, long only, you know, mostly fundamental analysis and just really looking at what are masterpieces I want to own in the portfolio for hopefully the rest of my life and or pass on to, you know, my children or grandchildren over time. So that's how I'm thinking about it. I really don't sell or trade at all. I don't try to look for new tickers every month or every year just to keep busy, you know, let the flowers grow, so to speak, and just let the wonders of compounding work their magic. That's really what I've learned the most. And I guess last thing is on Buffett. I think his 20 slot metaphor has really resonated with me, and just, you know, I'm probably around 20, if not higher than that by now, but it's just a great metaphor for thinking about investment decisions. And if I think, okay, I only get 20 of these in a lifetime, I better make sure this is something I really want to stick to. And just entering every decision with that framework is really powerful.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? A free flight to a bucket list destination? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
It sounds like your mom has made a big impact with, you know, the book on her nightstand and buying Apple early on. I think it's great to have a parental influence. Sean, I'm curious, were your family, were they investors? And did you guys talk investments around the dinner table? Did you have that kind of influence growing up?
No, I wouldn't say quite the same way. And my dad has always been very supportive of my journey with investing and wanting to learn about it. And he certainly did everything he could to, I guess, kind of feed my appetite and make sure that, you know, I was learning and growing productively. And, you know, he did do some things like when I was in high school, he gave me a little bit of my college fund to try my hand at investing with stocks. For me, I do remember, you know, I have an uncle who was, you know, he was a banker. And I remember that he would sit around and he'd read the Wall Street Journal in the morning and drink his coffee and then he'd watch CNBC. And so I remember almost looking up to the success he'd had in life and wanting to mimic some of his daily habits. And so I thought, you know, let me just start reading about the markets in the mornings and let me watch CNBC and I'll have a successful life as well. So you know, I certainly had a number of positive influences in my life that allowed me to have those early touch points with investing in finance and approach it honestly and just being allowed to learn and make mistakes and fail, which is the most important part. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people don't have those positive role models in a financial capacity to look up to sometimes. And so you're not always allowed to fail. And all of a sudden, investing becomes this overwhelming and kind of scary thing that, you know, again, people are afraid to make mistakes. Like, what if I invest in the wrong thing? Or, you know, I don't know what I'm going to be doing. And then you almost get paralyzed by paralysis by analysis, right? And you get paralyzed and there's an element of inaction that comes into it, or even just a fear of, you know, rebalancing your portfolio and checking back up on it. Cause it's like, oh, well, I put everything together and let me just leave it. I don't want to mess with it anymore.
One of my favorite chapters, Matthew, you mentioned the psychology of money. My favorite chapter, and I've said this before on previous episodes, is the last chapter called Confessions, where he just kind of takes a look under the hood of how he manages his own money. So I kind of wanted to talk a little further about that, Matthew. You touched on it to some degree, but I really wanted to talk about like money moves that you specifically have made coming out of college, what you're doing now. You mentioned the 20 punch ticket kind of theory that I really like a lot, but talk to me more about some money moves that you're making that you think somebody that is just starting out that's listening to this and investing would be smart to consider.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly no expert and always open to learning new things. But from what I've learned, both from mistakes and some successes here and there is, you know, I guess to start simple with living below your means and trying to invest the difference. As silly as that sounds, it's amazing. My mom's influence was a blessing, but also on the other end of the token, had I not had that, I don't know where I would be investing wise, because it's not taught in public school, at least where I was. And really in business school, I don't know if anyone really even threw up like a basic compounding chart of just like, you know, S&P the last 100 years. Like that was not part of the repertoire of the coursework. So that's just to have, you know, to both of your points, to have those role models is in a way unfair because, you know, it's just kind of luck and who you're surrounded around when you're growing up. But that was the biggest thing, is just surrounding myself around those people. And that was her motto as well. It's just, you know, anytime she got a bonus or a little bit of extra money, it was invested. It was not, here's a new car, let's go to the Bahamas. It was, you know, let's just put a little bit away and let compounding work. It's magic. And that's the biggest thing. Like we can get into allocation and everything, but
yeah, I kind of was curious. Are you more of an active investor or do you siphon off funds into index funds? I kind of wanted to talk about passive versus active investing, what you personally do.
So personally, I have a small allocation to, you know, S&P 500 and the Qs basically, mm-hmm. But most of it is, like I said, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon are my biggest players, which, you know, kind of boring, but that's what I've stuck to, and incredible companies. And then of the last probably 3+ years, dollar cost averaging into Bitcoin. Part of that is, you know, Preston to blame, right, his insights, and just still have a lot to learn on Bitcoin, but the technology is fascinating. And thankfully the dollar cost average approach has worked for people the last, you know, call it 10, 15 years. Really excited to follow it as well. So Apple used to be a sizable part of the overall portfolio, and slowly Bitcoin is making up a much larger part of that, both by appreciation and then just by adding a little bit every month. So I think it's somewhere around almost 50% right now, Bitcoin. And feel pretty strongly about that. It used to be under 20%, and we'll see where it goes from here. But I'm just going to keep adding no matter if, you know, rises 30% tomorrow or drops 30%.
The dollar cost averaging is really a great way to go. And I think I was listening to a podcast this morning. There's not too many people that are sitting in a loss on Bitcoin at this point. It's worked out pretty well. And the whole Michael Saylor MicroStrategy strategy that he's pulled off is pretty remarkable to watch and what's been going on. And I know Preston's a big fan of what he's been doing in the last 4 years or so that he's been in Bitcoin. But Sean, what about you? I want to take a look under the hood. What do you personally recommend and some of the moves that you're doing in your own portfolio?
Yeah. Well, you know, just to echo Matthew a little bit too. I mean, it is so easy to get lost in like the individual stock picks. And for some people, that's where they start with their personal finances. And so I would just say generally, what's going to be most important for most people is make sure you have an emergency savings fund. Are you matching out your 401k up to your employer match? Are you taking advantage of, you know, IRAs, Roth or traditional? Do you have health insurance? You know, those are the kind of like basic questions. And then, you know, once you set those basic standards and you know, you figure out how to budget, you figure out that you're allocating to your retirement, then the question is, with this 20, 30, 40%, whatever it is, what fraction of my income that I'm going to be investing with, what decisions am I going to make with it? And, you know, generally, this is something I've talked about before, but the, you know, there's an illusion of passive and active. And I guess in the traditional sense, I would call myself a blend of passive and active, but I would also push back on that and say, you know, there's, in a way, there's no such thing as passive investing. There's really just, you know, are you aware of the decisions and trade-offs you're making, or are you not aware of the decisions and trade-offs you're making, right? For example, you know, people will say passive investing is buying the S&P 500. Well, the S&P 500 is an index that's formulated by S&P Global, right? And so there are active decisions as to what companies get included and cut from that. And then you say, well, I buy, you know, the entire market. And then I would say, okay, well, you know, how is that index listing every publicly traded stock? Is that equally weighted? Is that market cap weighted? So for me, one of the things has just been over the last couple of years, learning about those trade-offs and not just saying, I'm going to be a passive investor. I'm an active investor and I only pick, you know, Warren Buffett style stocks. Mm-hmm. It's just at every step of the road, trying to understand the trade-offs that I'm making with my finances and why those might be important. And then, you know, another point I would want to make too is connecting back to anti-fragile and something that Nassim Taleb talks about is this concept of via negativa. And so, you know, we often, when we think about whether it's with our health, our relationships, with our money, we think about, you know, how can we add more? And somehow we're going to add something that's going to help us. And it's going to be some new supplement or some vitamin, or, you know, we're going to add more exercise into our routine, or we're going to add this stock to our portfolio, and it's going to dramatically improve things. And, you know, the principle of via negativa is, you know, first, let's focus on what we should avoid. What should we not do? And so, you know, maybe with health, it's like, okay, well, rather than trying to train to run a marathon, well, let's start with cutting out the junk food or, you know, whatever it is. And literally the via negativa and just removing the things that are weighing on you or killing you or whatever it is. And instantly you could have order of magnitudes improvement in the structure of your portfolio or your health or whatever it is. So, you know, in my portfolio for me, and my question often is that quote unquote passive tilt where I try to own, you know, most of the market generally in, you know, various ETFs. And then I think a lot about what do I want to avoid? And so for me, that's, I don't invest in Chinese stocks. You could say that, you know, I'm missing out on the world's second biggest economy, that I'm missing out on, you know, perhaps some of the best tech companies in the world. But for me personally, it's not a place that I've thought through a lot of. I don't feel comfortable with the ownership rights there, the governance, the tensions of being a US citizen and trying to invest in a place like that. There's just trade-offs that I don't want to make with my money there. And it's a place that I avoid. And so I only invest in, for example, emerging markets ETFs that don't include at all or greatly minimize their exposure to Chinese and Taiwanese equities. So for me, to some extent, it's a question of that via negativa with my portfolio, where I start with the premise of let's own everything and then let's cut out the things I don't want to own. And of course, there are times where I see opportunities to zoom in on specific things and kind of tilt my portfolio weights in favor of things like Bitcoin or, you know, for example, commercial real estate has been beaten down a lot over the last 2 years. And I wouldn't necessarily say anybody go out and buy commercial real estate ETF or buy VNQ or, you know, whatever it is, just because, again, there's a lot of nuance to how these different strategies are. When we're talking about commercial real estate, are we talking about warehouses? Are we talking about office buildings? And what are we talking about, you know, what type of office buildings, like grade A or grade C, right? So there's just a lot of nuance to these types of things. But again, that's an example of where I have a few different ETFs with large commercial real estate exposure that I've been looking at and probably trying to tilt my portfolio towards what's a pretty beaten down section of the market. So it goes both ways. But like I said, I start with this premise of trying to own everything, figuring out what I want to cut out and don't want to own, short-term treasury bonds, don't want to own Chinese stocks, and also figure out where I want to tilt in favor to. If there's a big sell-off in a certain sector of the market, I might load up there. And that's kind of my general framework that I operate from.
I like that idea of via negativa and what to avoid. I remember you sharing with me kind of this idea of political risk. You had invested, I think, in a Russian ETF, like maybe right before the Russian-Ukraine conflict. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, it's a lesson I learned the hard way. This is, you know, applying Via Negativa for my portfolio is unfortunately not something that I was born intrinsically with the inclination to do, right? This is something that I've learned from experience. And so, you know, I think in 2020, 2021, I was looking around at actually what caught my attention specifically was this headline that oil prices had gone below zero. And how could they be negative? Mm-hmm. And I didn't think I understood anything about the oil market and futures trading. And COVID was a crazy time. And we were, you know, a few months into lockdown, whatever it was. But I knew enough about finance and economics that oil prices are not going to be negative forever. And this seems like a pretty good time where you could buy in. And they're certainly not going to go more negative over the next 6 months or a year. This is a good time to buy in and look for the upside. So that initial train of thought, I started looking at buying individual oil and gas stocks and ETFs. And then I came across, you know, these Gazprom and some of these Russian oil and gas companies that were trading at PEs of like 5 to 10, even back in 2020, 2021. And they would have, you know, massive dividend yields, massive earnings yields, and also all the upside of the potential price appreciation of, you know, whenever we do recover from the this kind of COVID-induced recession. And we have more global demand for energy and gas, and energy, oil and gas prices surge again, they're going to have that bonus upside. And, you know, there are some other dynamics I was looking at, or the interest rate differential between the rates that would be paid on the Russian ruble versus the interest rates in the US were at zero. There are a lot of attractive elements in theory about why one should invest in Russia, right? I mean, there are so many things that seem like no-brainers to me. And it sounds, you know, I'm almost embarrassed to say now that I made those investments, but in 2020, it seemed like there were a lot of upsides in my favor. And obviously I've held on to those into 2022, when you had the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and it essentially became illegal to own any stocks and bonds in Russia. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was only 22 or 23 at the time. And so the amount of money that I was investing is ultimately inconsequential, but it was still, you know, a fraction of my net worth that essentially just went to zero immediately. And, you know, when you read John Bogle and Vanguard and the kind of passive investing and ETF approach to investing, you don't ever expect that you could just truly go to zero. That was not an idea. You're always told, oh, well, the S&P 500 has fallen 80% or 50% and it's fully bounced back. And the NASDAQ, you know, you always eventually bounce back. In this case, I don't want to say because of a technicality, but because of political risk and geopolitical tensions, you know, regardless of whether those companies are good to own. And the fact that I owned them in an ETF, right? It wasn't like I picked two or three stocks. I owned like 30 or 50 Russian oil and gas companies in this ETF. Unfortunately, yeah, because of that war, the geopolitical risk completely outweighed any of the upsides that I had thought were so attractive. And so I certainly didn't have an understanding of the geopolitical risks that I was taking, the nuances to owning international equities, and even the fact that in theory, sometimes you can be right. Objectively, I was right. Betting on oil and gas at that time was the right thing to do. And Russian oil and gas stocks were the cheapest ones to bet on. But, you know, there's a clash between the theory and reality. And so having appreciation for political risk, it's just something that I've come to think a lot more about over the last couple of years. And so, for example, like I said, when I look at China, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that I think there will be an equivalent fallout in relations between the US and China. But when you're talking about the chance of your portfolio being zeroed out, if you have 30%, right? Most emerging market ETFs, it's dropped now because Chinese equities are down a good bit. You know, the average emerging market fund, the MSCI index, is like 30 or 40% Chinese plus Taiwanese stocks. And so if you're putting a substantial chunk of your net worth into that, there's a chance that could get zeroed out for similar reasons. And so those are the kind of concerns. And that's where I say this is just something that's, it's a too difficult pile, as they say, that it's just not worth the downside risk of owning, and also the stress of trying to constantly monitor and think about how those risks are evolving over time.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey, everyone. It's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash Whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member of FINRA-SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into a partner bank where they can earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? A free flight to a bucket list destination? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
And I think it's such a good learning lesson to have this experience at a pretty young age in your investing career. I mean, this is a lesson that you'll never forget, right? That you'll carry forward for the rest of your life. It's really a pretty good lesson. Matthew, I wanted to kind of segue a little bit into your experience at TIP. You said you were listening to We Study Billionaires and some of the podcasts, but I wanted to hear a little bit more about how you found out about TIP and the newsletter and the process of applying and then coming on board to TIP and just what the experience has been like for you.
Sure. Yeah. Don't remember, honestly, the exact specifics of how I came across the job posting. I think I had just been a big listener and ended up going to the site. And I want to say I just saw one of the postings and submitted the application. I believe the sample writing piece was reflections on a Warren Buffett interview on one of the podcasts. Might have been a Robert Hagstrom interview who wrote the Warren Buffett Way, and probably should have mentioned that as an informative book. Love how he talks about quote in there where Warren says, "Robert, we're just focus investors." And that really well articulates so much of what Warren's about in that mentality. So that was the application, and ended up speaking with, you know, a former podcast host and Robert, and then Sean and Stig as part of the interview process. Was challenged during that process, I think a couple of times, and they asked really great questions. It was not a breeze hiring process by any means. Fortunately, they brought me on, which I'm so grateful for. This has been by far the most exciting, education-filled, peaceful, happy work environment that I've been a part of. And I'm not just saying that. It's really been, as Stig says, optimizing for happiness. And you can see that this is not a work around the clock environment. This is for the most part, work when you want and how you want, and really just putting us in the driver's seat, sort of giving the point guard of the team sort of the reins to run the offense the way they want to. So I love that we can just get up every day and look at that blank newsletter, Sean and I, 7, 8, 9 a.m. and try to make work with that blank canvas and just make something that will resonate with people in such a clickbait, headline, crowded media space overall.
Right.
And I'm just speaking generally as newsletters as part of media and really just trying to differentiate ourselves, educate readers, inform them. And as Sean and Stig have sort of laid it out in some of our emails, every day we're getting feedback from Stig. And I think one of the lines that stood out was, we're taking care of the reader. And I really like that phrasing and just sort of serving the reader and just trying to walk them through a scenario and explain a financial concept beyond just the stock moving up or down or an energy market doing X, Y, Z, but really explaining why and telling the story behind that.
Sean, how about you? Talk a little bit more about your experience of coming on. You shared a little bit about early on that you were listening to a lot of podcasts, but I want to talk. You trained me on the newsletter and I learned a ton from you and kind of onboarded me in many ways. So I want to hear a little bit more about your experience coming on into TIP.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I think I joined February 2022 or March 2022. And there was this like 3 or 4 month gap, right? We didn't actually start publishing the newsletter until July. But the whole purpose that I was hired for was to write the newsletter. But because of some, you know, advertising arrangements we had in place, we weren't going to start until July. And so I had almost 3 or 4 months of kind of empty time to fill. And so I spent a lot of that time just reading and learning and at Stig's guidance to some extent. And then also we kind of thought, you know, hey, we've been looking for a YouTube host, which is actually the job I originally applied for. And I said, you know, why do you have some time to kill? Why don't we send you a camera and start making some videos? And it was almost full circle because, like I said, when I originally applied to work at TIP, I had applied to be a YouTube host. And over the course of several rounds of interviews, they decided that I'd be better fit to be a newsletter writer. But so I ended up with cameras and it was quite a process to get everything. You wouldn't believe the amount of work that goes into a YouTube video and also, you know, even just our newsletter each day, just to get everything looking and sounding right. And so I know as a podcast host, Patrick, you can also appreciate that. So I had a several month stint just making basic YouTube videos about finance and book reviews before I settled in full time on focusing on our newsletter, We City Markets. And I know I had the privilege of working with you pretty early on, Patrick. And one of the kind of lasting messages that one of our colleagues told me of how to think about the newsletter is, you know, let's create something that's of the same quality of our flagship podcast, We Study Billionaires, and let's do it in newsletter form. And so I brought that to the newsletter very seriously of being a longtime fan of TIP and wanting to feel like I could recreate the same quality and value and trust with people that had been built up over our podcast over the years in this new media format. And I'd like to think that we've accomplished it, or we've put a lot of work into just getting better every single day. And I mean, I know we look back at the early editions of the newsletter and on a day by day, a week by week basis and month by month basis, I mean, it has just gotten exponentially better. And that's not because we're brilliant people, but that's just because we've been so humble of every day. We say like, what can we do? How can we improve this? Should this be shorter? Should this be longer? Can we do a better job explaining it? You know, would this font look better? Should we bold this? Where should we add in links? And just every day we being willing to change and being flexible and having an open mind for how you can improve things. And so, you know, sometimes I look back at some of the first newsletters I wrote and that also we wrote jointly together and I cringe. And then I also kind of see the beauty of that progression that we've made along the way. And, you know, it's certainly busy. As Matthew said, you start every day with a blank slate, which is scary to an extent. You know, when you're focused primarily on writing the newsletter, every day is a new day. And it's not really like any other job. You know, I've had other jobs and plenty of friends who work, you know, in insurance and banking and regular types of job. And your work carries on day to day, right? Mm-hmm. You might have projects you do for weeks or months, but, you know, with a daily newsletter, it's kind of something you craft and curate. It exists for a single day and you spend all day working on it and then you send it out. And then by the next day, it's already outdated and you're on to the next one. You know, and there's not necessarily a continuity of newsletters, right? Every day is kind of a new day when you're trying to provide current market news to keep people informed about what's happening. So even just that process of starting anew every single day has been humbling because, you know, sometimes you say, man, I wrote a killer newsletter yesterday. Yeah. And then it's like, on to the next. And yep. So it's very humbling. You know, like your ego can't latch on to success too much because you're always turning a new page constantly.
Yeah, it's like you're creating a baby every day and releasing it out into the world and moving on to the next baby.
Right. It's like the, you know, the like sand mandalas. I'm not sure what they're called. Yeah. These intricate artworks that are drawn in sand and then they're just immediately, they're cleared away as soon as they're finished. It's kind of what, not to compare, you know, our newsletter writing to the beauty of that type of art, but it is the same idea of you put so much effort into something and then you just wipe the slate clean.
It's a great analogy. It's really true. There's so much work that goes into a newsletter. I don't know that the average person can really, you know, when they see the finished product, appreciate how much work that actually goes into each day producing that much content. And I remember the early days, the newsletter was way longer and like it was a lot more content to produce. And Yeah, it's interesting to see the evolution. For our listeners, though, that aren't current subscribers, Matthew, can you talk a little bit about, like, more in depth about what the newsletter is geared toward, what you're trying to accomplish, the mission, that kind of thing?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, in a nutshell, the biggest stories in financial markets every day. That's how I think Sean came up with that tagline. And that just speaks to what we're after. We're not necessarily chasing every, you know, stock that's moving around or what some pundits said on TV, but really just what are the big market movers, or in some ways, what is a story that's being overlooked, but we think is substantial, generally long-term, even though it's a daily newsletter. We're trying to think about things that are going to have bigger effects down the line. So that's what we're after. We also obviously keep track of S&P, NASDAQ, Bitcoin, oil, gold, all of that's in every newsletter. We usually try to sprinkle in a little fun in the intro and some charts as well, which we've really doubled down on the last, call it what, maybe a year, Sean, of really just adding more visuals so that people who, you know, realistically are commuting home or in line at the grocery store on their phone, reading it, they might be skimming or scrolling. So we do want to have, speaking to the mission point, we do want to have something accessible, something where you don't need an MBA to understand, something that, you know, in all honesty, probably a college student would be able to understand virtually every word, because we're really spelling it out. Credit to Sean for, you know, financial terminology, really just spelling that out for readers, which you don't always get when you're reading the Wall Street Journal or Bloomberg, which are great, you know, great platforms. But we really try to educate and inform and add those definitions, add those examples, add those stories to the headlines. So that's it in a nutshell. We'll have some pop quizzes, some polls for fun as well, and just to sort of put a cherry on top.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I look forward to getting it every day. Sean, I wanted to hear a little bit more from you about just how the newsletter, how you think about the evolution of it. Like, you were there at the very start of it, started it. I mean, you're the founder in many ways. How has it changed over time? Like, how would you say it's kind of progressed? And you said it's gotten a lot better, and it has. Talk to us a little more specifically about that.
It was one of those things where we truly started with the newsletter, with an open canvas. I was just asked to take, we built up this email list over years of doing the podcast, but we weren't necessarily emailing people and communicating with folks who had signed up to hear from us. And so, you know, the mission was kind of just, hey, let's build a daily newsletter. And then Sean, you can figure out what it should look like, how it should read, how it should sound. And so, you know, it wasn't this kind of thing where, like, from day one, I didn't even really know who I was writing for, right? Like, you're trying to figure out who's actually going to read this, who is this going to be valuable for? And that's kind of one starting place. And then from there, you have to figure out, okay, you know, how should this actually look? How should it flow? What should the tone be, right? Should it be more casual and fun, or should it be very serious and professional? So there's a lot of different ways we've gone. I would say we've pushed in those different directions over time. And I would probably say at the beginning, I thought I almost took it more seriously than I needed to.
What do you say more about that? Serious in what way? The tone of the writing was more serious?
Yeah, just like having fun, you know, making jokes, interesting, linking to interesting things, even in pop culture and stuff, you know. But when I first started, I think I thought I needed to have this very strict financial markets focus and just talking about numbers and treasuries and stocks and exactly what's happening at a very technical level. And over the course of doing it daily for nearly 2 years, now this is something Matthew and I have talked about. We just want to have fun with it, right? Like, when you're having fun with what you're doing, you just, life is a lot better. And so in some ways, the newsletter has, I would say, become more casual. It's become more fun to write and hopefully to read, and hopefully just easier to read too. And so, yeah, like I said, it's been a constant work in progress, but, you know, we've ended up in this place where we realize, like, you know, I used to, when we first started, I think about, you know, okay, I'm writing it for this person, John Smith, 40 years old, who lives in Maryland, or, you know, and you'd have some idea of who you're writing for. And over the course of time, it took me a little bit to learn the wisdom of, you know, just put something out that you want to read and that's interesting to you. And so that's ultimately where we've leaned into, is I think really it's gone from me thinking about trying to make something that would make other people happy, and to just creating, you know, knowing that I'm an investor and somebody very interested in finance myself, and just figuring out, you know, what would I enjoy reading? And yeah, that's where we've ended up. And, you know, along the way, we've learned some small things of just, like, that I've thought about is, you know, how exclusionary a lot of the language is in finance and business in general. And even you open up CNBC, which is considered the most mainstream and accessible, you know, business and financial media company, and there's just still so much jargon that's used. And sometimes people don't ask, like, the first questions first and the principles of, like, what does it actually mean? You know, what is actually inflation? And what is an interest rate and why is it important? And so, you know, we don't always go through it at such a basic level in every single newsletter. But, you know, if you're reading every day, I think you'll see that we take a lot of those opportunities to just zoom in ways that other people don't and answer those principal questions of like, sometimes you just take for granted that you think you understand something and you have to have somebody else push you and remind you of like to question, you know, something you just assumed that you understood about financial markets. And this is why IPOs happen the way you do. And you just take it for granted. That's what the way it is. And it's like, well, hey, maybe there's a different way to do an IPO, right? And so just those are a few examples of how we've tried to, as Matthew said, try to make things as accessible as possible to people and retaining the sophistication of the concepts while removing the exclusionary jargon that makes people feel like they're not qualified to read business and financial news.
Matthew, I wanted to hear a little more about, as you're going through the process of writing, what are some of your favorite resources that you're turning towards to craft the newsletter?
Yeah, so certainly mainstream news, like Sean said, we're reading just sort of, we probably get, I don't know, Sean might get a bunch as well. I probably get at one point 20 newsletters in my inbox a day.
Yeah.
And part of that was just sort of seeing what other people are doing. I've since unsubscribed and clean out the clutter a little bit, but we're just reading all of those, you know, scanning CNBC. Sometimes I'll scan CNN and CNN Business just to get a pulse. We're not necessarily writing anything based on those articles, but just to sort of get a feel for what's going on in the day, both financially and not. I think the main ones Sean and I keep coming back to are Bloomberg, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, occasionally New York Times and Washington Post. Those are the, let's just call it four or five that I'm reading every single day that we have accounts with. And we're reading, you know, the financial market stories, but some of those publications also have more business and tech stories as well that we might sprinkle in the newsletter. Occasionally we'll throw in a sports story, whether it's, you know, LeBron James's holdings or Michael Jordan being a billionaire. How does he look about markets and, you know, NBA ownership, for example, or brand deals. So we try to have fun with it, certainly primarily looking to those publications for, you know, traditional market stories, but we will branch out a little bit and anything just sort of with the ancillary business and financial stories as well for some people.
Sean, talk to me a little bit about like the vision of where you want the newsletter to go. Currently, you're at, tell me again, what number of subscribers and just kind of your vision for the future for the newsletter.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're at about 32,500 subscribers and I'd like to grow it to hundreds of thousands and millions. And, you know, I was actually looking back at a publication we've learned a lot from, and that's Morning Brew. And I think they're at several million folks who read that. And they just celebrated their 10-year anniversary. And so, you know, sometimes I'm frustrated, I have my head down and I'm thinking, you know, why are we not getting more people to read this? How can we get it to grow faster and that stuff? And then other times I think about, you know, it's just a long journey to really, truly, I think of it as we're building a business with the newsletter. It's a long journey to build trust with people and add enough value to them that they'll recommend reading it to others. And you just build that sort of following organically. So it's a work in progress. We're almost 2 years in and I'm proud of a lot of what we've accomplished. And I think there's plenty of room to, you know, as we've been talking about, I think that our message resonates with a lot of people of, who want to keep on top of the biggest stories in financial markets and they don't want the jargon and they want easy to read charts that, you know, be cliche, right? A picture is worth a thousand words. And sometimes you can convey so much more in a simple chart than you can in a thousand word write-up. And so we just try to blend as many of those elements as possible of coming up with jargon while also touching on the nuance of financial stories. Because what kills me sometimes too is that when there are plenty of folks who do try to very like dumb down what's happening in the economy or in the stock market, and some of that stuff is just hard to read because there's no appreciation for the nuance and coloring between the lines of how complicated some of these stories can be. And unfortunately, the gap that we're trying to fill is that for more of that nuance, oftentimes you have to go to these legacy financial publications that are very technical and very filled with jargon. And so kind of the opportunity we see with folks is to, you know, go deeper than most mainstream media goes on financial and investing topics, while also not having the same jargon that you would get if you picked up a Wall Street Journal or a Bloomberg. So the message that I hope resonates with a lot of people, and so far it seems like we had a chance to meet up with some readers when we were in Omaha last year for the Warren Buffett or to the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting. And so, you know, from what I can tell people, it resonates with them. And also for me, it's just a message that is compelling because sometimes I read things and there's so much jargon in it. And I'm like, God, I know a lot about finance, but I feel dumb reading this. I have no idea what they're talking about. And then you look up, you know, the terms and the language that's being used and you realize, oh, this is actually very basic concepts that are just being packaged in this way that you know, coming back to that word exclusionary, I think honestly, you know, for a long time, Wall Street money managers have built up a reputation of they want everything they do to be as esoteric as possible. They don't want the average person to understand what they're doing, because if people understood the actual money moves that your average mutual fund or hedge fund manager are doing, you wouldn't pay them the type of fees that you're paying them, right? I mean, your average money manager is not doing anything extravagant, and they're not some, you know, brilliant Wolf of Wall Street type of person. They're just making very basic moves for the most part. And they try to use, I think there's a culture of language that's been perpetuated over several decades of making yourself sound more important and kind of self-flattering language of just making things very technical and they don't need to be. So, you know, that's kind of my rant about it. But, you know, the more I've peeled back the onions of the financial world and each layer I go through, I realize just like there's a lot of that element of people wanting to sound like they're more sophisticated than they are so they can justify charging higher fees. And that's the unspoken truth. And, you know, I'm not going to say that we're going to peel back every layer of the onion for everybody who reads We Study Markets, but we really make a deliberate effort of to just shine a light on dynamics like that, and also just to cut through the BS and cut through the jargon and just put things out there plainly. And also just a respect for people in that we don't need to tell them what to think, right? We think of it as truly like we're presenting information for people to decide on their own what they think about different matters in the financial markets.
You guys are doing a great job at it. I know one of the key metrics is open rate. And the last time I checked, it was over 50% open rate, which is just testament to the high quality nature of the newsletter that, and, you know, and the quality content that you guys are putting out every day. I think it's rare to get that kind of number of over 50% is fairly rare in the newsletter world. Matthew, I've been reading lately about We Study Markets Pro. So can you talk to me a little bit about that? I'm curious about what the new developments are with the newsletter and We Study Markets Pro.
Yeah, well, thank you for the kind words, Patrick. Certainly, you know, we're not about clicks. We're about information. And of course, we want people to read our work. No doubt, we're not going for high traffic just for the sake of traffic. Right. We're really going for the educational component. As Sean said to me the other day, we'd rather have fewer subscribers who are really engaged and educated and learning than, you know, a list way bigger, but people aren't really opening it, or they're just skimming it, or not interacting with them. So let's just close that loop there. Yeah, as far as the We Study Markets Pro, we're excited to roll that out. It's $67 a month, and you get one weekly strategy report featuring market charts and historical data to inform and educate investors on their decisions. That's weekly. We have an occasional signal report as well, based off of an economic release, like an inflation print, for example. We'll have something right shortly after those releases. We'll have a quarterly webinars, and then we might roll out some other features as well. But everybody gets a free trial to start, cancel anytime if you don't like it. And we'd love to have you on board. We welcome you to a one-on-one intro call and hear about what you're looking for, how you think about markets, how you like to invest, what you like to read. And that can help shape our product as well. So we're very much listening and interested.
Yeah. And just to add to that too, right? You know, the daily newsletter that we normally put out, just We Study Markets, it is free for everybody to read and access. And the aim of that, as we've talked about for the last few minutes, is to educate and inform people. And that certainly doesn't change at all. But the idea with We Study Markets Pro is to go and take the kind of information that's being provided, you know, generally keeping people up to date on markets and We Study Markets. And We Study Markets Pro provide actionable insights and actionable, you know, institutional level, hedge fund level data that the professionals are honestly paying big money for to access. And we're taking some of that data, and the hope is to distill it and deliver it into, you know, weekly actionable reports for folks that they can actually make decisions off of.
It sounds like good stuff. I mean, one of the great things about TIP is it is super entrepreneurial. I mean, Sean, you've started a newsletter and you guys have run with it. And this is like a new development that will be exciting to see how it unfolds. And I just want to thank you guys. This has been a lot of fun for me. Fun to learn more about you, and just your insights on things are really helpful. And Sean, for people that want to get in touch with you, talk about how they can do that, and a little bit more about how to subscribe to We Study Markets too, if you could touch on that.
Yeah. Well, you can just go to theinvestorspodcast.com. It's our home-based website for all of our podcasts and our newsletter. There should be a few pop-ups that you'll see in different places for you to input your email. You can also go into under the Academy tab. There's a drop-down and you can click on newsletters. You can see our whole archive of recent newsletters. You can subscribe, and you can also check out We Study Markets Pro from there as well. So Yeah, I really appreciate you having us on, Patrick. And you know, if you do have questions about the about We Study Markets or We Study Markets Pro, you can just email us at newsletter@theinvestorspodcast.com. And we open every email that comes in there, and we make an effort to respond to everybody who writes in.
Awesome. Matthew, how can people get in touch with you? And if they want to reach out and have questions about, you know, anything, whether it's market related or We Study Markets Pro, or just rap about some of the books you mentioned, how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, best way is email. Like Sean said, we read every email. We love hearing from our readers. So I'm Matthew@theinvestorspodcast.com. And you can also check us out on Twitter/X. We're at We Study Markets there. We're posting a lot more regularly of late. So check us out there. And we do have some presence, like Sean said, of course, TIP on YouTube generally, and Facebook as well.
Awesome. Gents, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, folks, that's all I had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you back here real soon.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on our episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.